Hello, this is Mark Shanton for Theatre Voice. I'm joined by critics Charles Spencer, Matt Wolfe and David Benedict to talk about three new productions that have just opened in London in the same September week. At the Donmar Warehouse, Christopher Hampton's 1970 play, The Philanthropist, is revived in a production marking the return of Simon Russell Beale to the Donmar for the first time since Sam Mendes directed him in the title role of Uncle Vanya. As another perennially disappointed type, this time playing a bachelor, University Don, picking his way tentatively and apologetically through life in David Brindley's production. At the Almeida, Romance is David Mamet's latest play, a frantic courtroom farce, first stage at New York's Atlantic Theatre Company earlier this year, and now receiving its British premiere in Lindsay Posner's production that features John Mahoney, best known from television's Frasier, as Marty, as the judge presiding over the escalating chaos of a trial. And at the National Theatre, Mike Leigh's first new stage play for 12 years has finally arrived, 2 years after it was first announced, but just 2 weeks after it was finally given a title, 2,000 Years, that follows a secular North London Jewish family over a year in their lives. Reviews have been decidedly mixed for The Mamet, while Mike Leigh's play has had a better critical reception so far. But of all of them, there seems to be no disputing that Simon Russell Beale is offering the performance of the week and quite possibly his career in The Philanthropist. So let's see if our panel agree. First of all, Charlie, what did you make of Simon Russell Beale?
Oh, it was lovely. It's sort of a role he was born to play, and my worry before going to the show was that often when people seem to be born to play a role, it never quite works, you know, that they're too perfectly cast for it. But in the role of Philip, the sort of bumbling Don, very much an Oxbridge Don, I would say, and a philologist in this play, he's just perfect, and the only thing I've got against the production is that it's surprisingly clumsily staged by David Brindley, so that quite often you can't see his face when you really want to. He's sitting in a chair with his back to the audience. But when you can see his face, it is so eloquent. I mean, every movement and every line really sort of suggests this sense of sort of fear and defeat and panic and need, terrible need. He's a wonderfully needy actor, I always think. And it really is a beautiful performance. There's one extraordinary bit where this femme fatale is trying to seduce him, which is the last thing he wants to happen. And you see him sitting very uptight and intense in his chair while she stands behind him and ruffles up his hair, which all sort of stands on end. And he looks like this sort of terrified hedgehog that sees this lorry coming towards him and there's nothing he can do to avoid it. It's a really fabulous performance, I think.
The technical problem you pointed out about the views, I mean, that is a problem in the three-sided auditorium often. What did you make of that bit?
I would slightly go to the defence, actually, of the staging. If you've got, it's very difficult working on three sides, but there's a very easy way of doing it. You play on the diagonals, basically. And Sam Mendes, in 10 years at the Donmar, never worked out how to stage anything. People never, ever, ever sat with their backs to the front row of the audience in a Sam Mendes show. But what that meant was that anyone on the sides had a fairly lousy time, particularly in Sam's final two productions where there were letters of complaint to the Donmar because people sitting further away from the front head-on couldn't actually see a thing because so much of it was staged down. So I missed bits of Simon Russell Beale's performance, but that didn't really seem to bother me. I do have problems with Simon Russell Beale, who I think is a really most extraordinary actor who is able to convey thought and to absolutely isolate out separate thoughts on every single moment, and that's dazzling to watch. But with a weak director, as he has had in John Caird, and to a similar-ish degree with David Brindley, sometimes the play gets sandbagged because he's thinking so many thoughts, and you marvel at his ability to do all that and to absolutely understand what he's thinking, but it slows the entire play down and it sets a very slow rhythm which kills some of the comedy and also drags other people down with it. Danny Webb, who's an actor with fantastic front-foot energy, gives a slightly subdued performance here because the whole thing is being played so thoughtfully and slowly that it just gets... It's a very infectious rhythm. I really wish someone would say to Simon Russell Beale, I know you're thinking 27 thoughts at this point, but you need to make a choice and perhaps play three of them and keep the scene moving. It pays off at the end. The last scene, the reserves of emotion that he manages to display and our understanding of the thought processes is absolutely fantastic. But up until that point, sometimes I just thought, you need to act faster.
It certainly slowed down fatally. Lee in Macbeth, didn't it, to a virtual standstill.
That production was 2 hours and 50 minutes, and the Tony Sher one was 2 hours and 10.
Yes, exactly. Matt, what did you think of Simon Russellville?
Oh, I thought he was extraordinary. I mean, you know, you talk about the performance of his career. It's so hard to say it because his career has had so many remarkable signposts. I guess what's fascinating about this is that it seems of a piece with so many other Simon Russell Beale parts and performances from
Humble
the
Boy,
Nebuchadnezzar. Well, yeah, but even going further back, the Nebuchadnezzar Academic and Some Americans Abroad that he did for the RSC.
And Constantine, didn't you think at the end?
Absolutely. Through to Humble Boy. Of course, his recent performance in the revival of Jumpers. And yet what's interesting is that he seems to reinvent it fresh each time. It's not that he's pastiching or parodying or just parroting what he's done before. He makes it fresh. And in this, I thought what was extraordinary was nobody does English emotional paralysis better than he. And yet, at the same time, there's a kind of paradox about it because he's playing inertia with an incredible amount of focus and energy. And that's actually quite extraordinary. There were moments where he seemed to be lit up from within. Literally, you looked at his eyes, and they seemed to be kind of gleaming this force field. There are lines in the play that I went back and looked at afterwards because I thought they must have been interpolated for him, like a comment where his fiancée says, "You just sit there like a pudding wobbling gently," because you think that has to be made to order. It's right there in the text, so it's a perfect fit.
What's interesting is it is a 35-year-old play. I mean, they are staging it somewhat as a period piece. The girls are still in period costumes, but the play does feel very alive. What did you find that?
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely.
It's got a sort of classic quality, I think, and I think it is a really fine example of sort of high English comedy. I mean, the writing has a mixture of economy and exuberance about it, I think, and, you know, there's line after line that is just bang on. It's a bit Stoppardian, isn't it? Mm. But it hasn't got the prolixity of Stoppard. It's sort of like Stoppard pared to the bone. I mean, what is it, an hour and 50 minutes? If Stoppard had written the same play, it would have been 2 hours, 50 minutes, I would say. And there doesn't seem to be a sort of word wasted. And it's also got a great humanity about it, I think.
Although I think it also has a quite potent undertow of terror.
Terror,
I mean, yes. Fascinating at the end of the first act, the very last line is, "God help us all," yeah. Which I found deeply disturbing.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed, probably as someone who's had a bit of experience with shrinks, is it's actually a play about this psychological condition known as people-pleasing, you know, and he's a chronic people-pleaser, and he actually says that he's doing this through that this is part of his terror that's driving him to do this. I don't think that phenomenon was around in 1970. I think it's quite a recent thing, and I tell you, when I spent my time in the Priory, it was all about people-pleasing, and I think Hampton sort of spotted something there, which is now seen as a psychiatric condition, which was not spotted before. So it's very on the money, I think.
I think so. I mean, I think that for all its verbal felicity, and this is a play I've long admired, I do think that there are significant flaws, notably the women's roles. I mean, I think the two actors in this production are
Anna Madley and
Anna Madley and Siobhan Hewlett are very impressive. Anna Madley in particular, who has a much more significant role, a role, I believe, created by Penelope Wilton. But they are underwritten, and it's nothing to do with the way Simon Russell Beale looks or his presence or anything, but until the very last scene, it's a bit of a strain to work out why someone so deferential and unable to give an opinion is going to be marrying this extraordinary, beauty, smart, clued-up woman. You think, well, she might be interested in him, but I cannot see that engagement making sense. And I do think that the women's roles are seriously subsidiary.
Well, there's also the classic one of the woman who doesn't actually speak at all in the play, which must be the sort of year's least rewarding. She just has to simper a bit, doesn't she? It's a terrible tart to have to play.
Well, Christopher Hampton does say in one of his sort of reminiscences theatrically that there was a German production with the German actor Helmut Grimm, and who's very attractive, and that put a whole different cast on things because you could see the way in which this character became a kind of babe magnet. But I think what's interesting in this version is that there is something very sweet about Russell Beale in a way, and that kindness, particularly within the sort of viperish groves of academe, is something that even in my limited experience I can see would be potent.
Yes. And doesn't she say at one point, the Anna Madeley character, that She likes Russell Beale because he's unthreatening and because he's safe and reassuring. Yeah. And then at the end, I think rather wonderfully, she decides that's not what she's looking for at all, and she'd rather be shagging the ghastly novelist
Braham.
Charlie, you mentioned the resonances with Stoppard and compared that. Of course, there's also lots of comparison to Simon Gray's endless plays about academia. Mm. Yeah. Turning next to David Mamet's romance, Matt and Charlie, I think you've both seen it in New York earlier this year. How did this compare, Charlie?
It's a much better production, I think. It's got much more pace, it's peppier. He finds what little depth there is in the play, Lindsay Posner seems to find. It's a much better production. It was there were parts in the New York production where you just sort of gave up the ghost and despaired, really, because it was everyone hamming and mugging like mad and no emotional truth in it at all. This cast does the very best they can for it. It's still shit.
And Matt, what about you? Is that your judgment on the play?
Yes, I'm momentarily taken aback. It's much better than the New York production, which was so inept that it didn't even let you know what it was. You had no idea what the play was. You just sort of sat there in sort of advanced disbelief. At least here, it delivers up what the play is, which I happen to think is not much at all. And in fact, quite sort of, I don't know, there's something quite pathetic about this macho, you know, virile straight writer indulging dreadful jokes about gay men, and in an odd way, although we can talk about this later, it has sort of the same theme as the Mike Leigh play, because they're both plays set against the backdrop of the possibility of a Middle East peace process and Israel and Palestine, and yet both plays suggest that how can we make peace there if we can't make peace closer to home, either in the courtroom or in a living room. But it just doesn't land.
David?
I think this play is truly shocking for none of the reasons that David Mamet thinks it's shocking. I think this is possibly the worst written play by a serious dramatist I've seen in a very, very long time. I think this is quite shockingly arrogant as a piece of writing. Its cursory way with structure, its laziness, the way actors are left marooned whilst he pursues a tirade. There's a moment quite late on where Colin Stinton, as a defence attorney, wakes up to the fact that Nicholas Wooderson's prosecuting attorney is gay, because suddenly there's this revelation. But Colin Stinton's line about this comes, I would say, 3 minutes. Not 3 seconds too late, but 3 minutes too late. So quite what Colin Stinton is supposed to do whilst there's a tirade and whilst, you know, various things are going on, at which point he suddenly goes, hey, hang on, are you gay? And you think, this is so lazy. I cannot believe that this was written by the man that wrote Glengarry Glen Ross. You know, there we have a play from 1982 when Mamet was good, when he was able to write scenes with six people in, where the ball is never dropped, all those characters are constantly animated. It's very, very difficult to write plays with a lot of characters in. Most people write dialogue scenes because then it's just like table tennis. Six characters talking at the same time is really, really hard to give them all life. And this has none. And for me, I'm stunned to hear that Neil Pepe's production in New York was worse, because I thought this was pretty risible, with the exception of Paul Reddy and Nigel Lindsay, who keep their heads when all about are losing theirs.
You never find out, for example, what the court case is. Why is he on trial? I thought maybe I'd missed something.
That's Mamet's disdain for plot, because he's writing a burlesque or he's writing an absurd piece. That's fine if you wish to write a conversation piece or you know, to set up a joke where you go, you know, it's like a Hitchcock MacGuffin. You don't need to know what the uranium's really for and in Notorious. You don't need to know what this court case is actually about. It is merely a springboard for stuff. But if you're going to do that, you have to obey basic laws. You have to engage the audience. First scene went by, I didn't have a clue what it was about. Come to that, I still don't know what it was about, other than an attack on political correctness by a very smug Jewish writer. I say that as a Jewish man.
It really is an intolerable play, I think. And it's got this sort of knee-jerk... I thought it was a really horrible evening, because there's all this sort of knee-jerk reaction and laughter from the audience for lines that simply aren't funny. It's just this sort of showing off, I can do this. you know, I'm going to shock you. Well, Mamet can do that obscene dialogue, and it can be brilliant, but here it's just on auto. He could be writing it in his sleep.
I think it actually, though, says something about how generous theater audiences are in an odd way, because the first 10 minutes, if you listen very acutely, I thought on opening night, people weren't laughing. In fact, they seemed completely befuddled as to how to respond, and then they gently started laughing, and
it's
it's not because it got funny, it's because they thought, well, we might as well invest something
in it. But isn't
that
also because in a 300-seat theater like the Almeida, that audience is full of critics, donors, and friends of the family who are there to be supportive, and you know, stunned by the ineptitude of the first scene, they think, well, we better pull our socks up and start laughing.
I have to say, I think it's marginally better than Boston Marriage, which for me is the Mamet play that is obviously what this is for you, the stunt which was just one theatrical cap too far.
So, well, and also the Boston Marriage is so odious. It's, oh good heavens, I'm being attacked because I don't write gay characters. I know, I've got a really funny idea. Let's write two lesbians, one to be played by my wife and the other to be played by my mate Bill Macy's wife. Wouldn't that be funny? Thanks, David.
So why do you think the Almeida have actually done this play? I mean, obviously there's a temptation with a major writer to do all their work, but isn't there comes a point when you should just say no?
Well, actually, the night I saw it in New York, I was talking to somebody at the Atlantic, and they were getting a lot of interest from a lot of London theatres. It wasn't just the Almeida. The Donmar was considering it, supposedly. There was talk of possibly the Cottesloe.
And Lindsay Posner has done a lot of Mamet as well. I mean,
well,
I met
I met Lindsay Posner shortly after seeing it in New York and begged him not to do it. I said, just don't touch this one. And he said at that point that he'd read it and he wasn't going to do it. Mm. He changed his mind, and I accosted him at the first night and said, why are you doing this when you said you weren't going to do it? And he said he didn't know he'd got John Mahoney in the cast. But
well, also, he's doing the next play.
He's doing the next play, so...
double deal.
It's amazingly, it's had some quite good reviews, this play, and I do think it's a classic case of Emperor's New Clothes. I mean, this is a writer basically with nothing to say anymore.
And it just feels like this really sketchy first draft, and the fact that a couple of the performances... In fact, well, I mean, most of the people on that stage emerge with some degree of integrity, which, given the nonsense they have to spout, is some kind of achievement. But I don't get why Lindsay Posner has been taken on as the great Mamet director of our time. His production of American Buffalo at the Young Vic many years ago was okay, but since then, Sexual Perversity in Chicago is a play which should last about 55 minutes, and Lindsay's production lasted 1 hour and 20.
Well, with all those terrible scene changes.
With unbelievable scene changes. But he also had such a glamorous cast that it automatically sold out, that I suppose that is why he continues to be able to do it. But he said in an interview in The Guardian about how he feels really attuned to Mamet's rhythms, but I think he completely misunderstands the rhythms, because he directs the actors to speak rhythmically rather than with meaning. So there's a scene where Paul Reddy keeps trying to interrupt Nick Woodison. So he keeps saying, I, at which point Woodison has to interrupt him. But Posner is so interested in getting the rhythm of the I beat, that the interruptions never sound like anything. You go, why isn't he completing the line? Whereas actually, you know, keep the row going and let the interruptions take care of themselves.
Of course, John Mahoney is an original Chicago actor. I mean, we've had him here in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner at the Barbican a few years ago.
The Man Who's Coming to Dinner.
The man who came to dinner.
Yes.
Yeah.
We got there in the end.
Yes. Yeah. So he's the reason people will book tickets to see this, probably, to see the star of Frasier. And he's really quite funny in the circumstances.
Yes, I must admit, he did
make me laugh, I have to say.
Yeah. Me too.
Although I rather like Larry Brigman in New York, too, but John is even funnier.
Yeah. No, I think he does a very good spaced-out turn. I don't think it's a particularly difficult thing to do, but he does it very well.
It's probably quite fun to do, in a way.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. No, he said, I read an interview with him where he said it was the most outrageous thing he'd ever done. And it is an outrageous play.
But don't you think this whole production has turned into Every Man? It's one of those awful productions where it's every man for himself.
Yes.
So he's doing his shtick, other people are doing theirs. And, you know, this is a play badly. It's like an orchestra. They can all play their instruments without having a conductor. You don't need a conductor for a violinist to know how to play their way through Mahler 6, but you do need a conductor there to balance it and to pace it and to place it. And everybody's just going, right, this is what I'm going to do from here to the end of the play. Off I go.
Yeah.
Well, on that analogy of conducting, Mike Lee, with 2,000 years, we've been waiting for this play for a little while. 12
Not
years.
Quite 2,000 years.
Well, 12 years since his last play, and 2 years since The National announced this. Has it been worth the wait and the hype, Matt?
Well, There's a fascinating paradox about Mike Leigh in general and about this play in particular, which is that there's nobody on film or stage who is renowned for and at his best does create a better sense of life unfolding in its kind of natural rhythms and dynamics with all the kind of bumps and glitches and pain and joy along the way. Having said that, it seems to me the role of a theater and film artist is to make art out of life. And I have to say that although there were bits and pieces of this play that I greatly admired, it seemed very inchoate to me. And it didn't look at all to me like the sort of play that had been rehearsed over 18 weeks. I mean, some of it seemed sort of surprisingly unfinished and unsure about itself. The first act was very kind of lumpen in structure, almost like a blueprint for a movie rather than something organically theatrical. And I wasn't quite sure what the play was actually saying beyond stuff that was actually, when you pare it away, quite banal.
And you do wonder what Adam Godley must have spent 18 weeks doing.
Adam Godley, one of the great British actors whose performance in The Pillow Man I will never forget, is completely wasted.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think that that is indicative of a major structural problem. There were two previews cancelled. Normally, when theatres cancel their previews, it's because the Revolve isn't working or, the enormous set has somehow got stuck and they've got all, and they didn't have enough time to rig and focus. That's clearly not the problem here because we've got a very simple Alison Chitty North London home set. The reason that I would imagine that we had two cancelled previews is the play was not yet written. And that actually what I suspect happened is that you get 16 weeks of character development research. I mean, there's a scene towards the end of the first act where one of the characters, Josh, asks various people in the room what it means to be Jewish and what they think being Jewish means. And you think, that actually was what you started off with, Mike Leigh, when you put together a Jewish cast to do a play, which is a perfectly fine consideration. But I don't think that all the research and all the character work actually led to a satisfying plot. I think there are a great many felicities in this play, and it has a compassionate soul, which is really rare and utterly uplifting to see. But the problem with devised work, whether it's Mike Bradwell's work with the whole truck in the 80s and onwards, or Mike Leigh from a similar period to now, is that you get really interesting characters. Sometimes, if you're really good at devising, you get very good interlinked characters, which is why the marriage between Alan Cordier and Caroline Gruber is so affecting and beautifully played. But what you don't get is satisfying plots. And for Sam Spiro and Adam Godley, two tremendous actors, to get, 10 or 15 minutes of stage time each, less in poor old Adam Godley's sense, does rather suggest that they couldn't find a way of taking all that research and building it into a play for satisfying characters.
Indeed, at a press conference earlier this week, Nick Heitner said that the process only comes to fruition, only gels right at the end. He said he saw the first run through 2 weeks ago, at which point I said to him, in which case, why did you schedule so few previews? And he said that that's what Mike Leigh demands and only wants a few previews because presumably he needs to work to a deadline of some kind.
Well, but I do think that's kind of selfish because I really, really wouldn't want to have been Alan Cordier or Caroline Gruber or Nitzan Sharon or any of those people on the stage doing that first preview with a play where you're not sure of the ground beneath your feet. And it's fine for Leigh to make these structures and strictures, but actually those actors, unsure of what the play is until the very last minute, actually have to deliver it in front of an audience. They must have been like rabbits in front of headlights.
Now, Charlie, I know you think they delivered.
I think it's a fabulous play. I really liked it a lot. I mean, I can see, as you say, with all structured work, you're not going to get a very strong plot. I think you have to buy into that. I think what you do get absolutely marvellously in this play is a group of characters. And I think, Adam Godley, it's a tiny role, but it's a very sweet role. And I think Samantha Spiro, is it Spiro or Spiro?
Spiro.
And I think Samantha Spiro is a really great comic tour de force. I mean, she's like, it's like you've got this sort of Chekhov play and suddenly Beverly from Abigail's Party suddenly comes busting in. And I like that. You might say that it makes the play a bit broken backed. I think it makes it richer. But what I loved about the play is I thought the parents' relationship and the relationship with the son was just beautifully caught. And it actually has something very serious to say, this play, and I can't think of anyone else who's quite said it, which is that for a lot of people now, and it's not just for Jews, but it can just as well be Christians or moderate Muslims, religious faith has become something frightening and to be feared and worried about. 50 years ago, you know, if a Jewish family had a son who might be becoming a rabbi, they'd be thrilled
to bits.
They'd be
thrilled, absolutely.
And I think this makes a very important point about the age. And I do think it's got one line in it, which I think will go down as one of the, you know, one of the sort of great lines of recent drama, which is when the father, contemplating his son's religion, says it's like having a Muslim or a Martian in the house. I mean, I think that is the line that nails what we're feeling post 9/11, post 7/7, absolutely brilliantly. And I think only Mike Lee could do that. And the last thing I'll say, I won't go on, but I do think, well, the other thing I love about Mike Lee, and this play has it in spades, but you also get it in some of the films, I'm thinking particularly of Secrets and Lies, is an extraordinarily downbeat, yet incredibly touching and consoling ending. And you also get it in Life is Sweet, where the two sisters are talking, and one of them says to the other, do you want to borrow some money or something? And it's almost deadbeat, but it's beautiful, and it does signal a kind of hope.
It's funny you say that about the ending, because it's absolutely of a piece with those other endings that you mentioned. But I have to say, in the case of this play, I didn't feel it was at all earned. I feel that we spend 90% of the play looking at this sullen, by definition, incapable of speech fellow who doesn't reveal up anything about himself. We just have to take him as he is, as this glowering, gloomy presence. Then Samantha Sparrow bursts into the room. The result of that is that Josh Ben Kaplan, the son, is reduced to tears for whatever reason. And then the final scene, he and his father have affected some sort of rapprochement, but it has to be taken so much on faith.
But I don't know, but he's removed his couple, he's removed his, you know.
Yeah, I know, I know.
And
it's
I think there is a journey in there that I was prepared to take.
I think it's been signaled, not dramatized for me.
Also, what's interesting, I mean, you mentioned 7/7. I mean, the play is actually references it. Mm. It references the New Orleans hurricane. It's bang up to the minute, isn't it? Mm. I mean, will the play last the test of time in that sense?
Doesn't matter.
Well, I think it absolutely will. I mean, I think it'll be like The Philanthropist. You won't be able to, you know, updating the references would be completely hideous if you did this play in 30 years' time. But actually, it would be fascinating to see this play in 30 years' time and go, good heavens, that's what they were thinking in 2005. Because it absolutely, as Charlie says, it completely nail stuff. I also think it's really rather charming that you have a play that kind of gives a lie to all the Hampstead novels, plays that we've seen, because none of those are Jewish, and most of the people that live in Hampstead are Jewish.
Yes.
This actually is about a kind of Judaism that nobody talks about, which is secular Judaism. These, you know, this Jewish family don't go to shul. They don't go to synagogue. They absolutely feel culturally Jewish. They might as well be atheist.
Yes.
And that is really interesting, because the stereotypical Jew is, they are seen to be a whole series of things, and one of them is religious. And, you know, my immediate family are religious, but my personal family are not. You know, there are huge gradations. One would assume, from the way Jews are generally portrayed, that if you did the corollary with Christians, that every Christian you know would be going to church regularly, which of course is nonsense.
Is this Lee's first Jewish play?
As far as I know,
yeah.
He's never brought religion into it before.
There was Goose Pimples.
Well, that was an Arab character,
but in a specifically coming to a specifically Jewish household, I would say.
Oh, was it?
That was my memory of the Hampstead production.
Did they mention that they're Jews?
I think it was just assumed, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, there are all sorts of discussions we can have about that. You know, Harold Pinter, Jewish playwright? You know, there is the way one uses one's culture, background, faith, of course, is endlessly important.
I love that final joke as well. About
final joke, which we shouldn't reveal.
This is an absolute gem, isn't it? Yes.
I think it's also interesting how Lee, as who spent most of the last 12 years making movies, has actually now introduced lots of filmic techniques into his writing. The first act, certainly, it feels almost storyboarded. I mean, there's scenes which actually happen with hardly any script in them at all. Yeah. It's a scene in a moment, it then fade out.
And they get passing time, don't they? Yes. And there's actually a scene where the mother's with the son, the troubled son, and almost nothing happens, and yet there is so much going on stage. I thought it was very fun.
Whereas the second act becomes a kind of real-time family drama.
So. Although I have to say, in the first act, I felt as if Mike Lee was in the wrong medium, frankly, because what on film he could accomplish so neatly with a cut, I felt for most of the first act I was staring at black space while scene changes were happening, and that you just shouldn't be aware of that. For something that's supposed to be, by definition, organic, I was awfully aware of the contrivance to make the organic possible.
I'd absolutely get the sense And I don't want listeners to think that I didn't enjoy this, because I absolutely did. But I do think it's a flawed piece. And I think Mike Lee knows it's a flawed piece. I do think that it feels like they didn't quite get enough in the research process. I'm not sure what it's about. Because of the tenderness of the observation and the detail of the work that all those characters have done, it ends up being about Judaism and about family life and the way you deal with errant family members and the way that makes you think about each other. But I suspect that the play wanted to do more, and at some point they all got caught short and thought, we open in 2 weeks and we don't really have enough material, so let's just go back to those characters and those principles. Which is why you end up with characters with relatively little to do.
My feeling is that I don't think that, if you think of some of the best Mike Lee films, is they don't always quite add up, and it's that sort of fragmentary, not quite complete nature of
but
them
I think
that
Charlie,
I find very satisfying.
But I think, Charlie, the best films of his do deliver. They deliver a knockout punch emotionally. I mean, you know,
well, I found that this did, actually. For me, it did.
To me, it didn't, and I'm, you know, from a secular Jewish family, so this is right up my street. Mm. But I wasn't moved by this at all. I was fascinated, I was intrigued, but I wasn't moved.
So, but certainly, Mike Lee's last two plays, Smelling a Rat at Hampstead and then It's a Great Big Shame, didn't have a Stratford East, didn't have a further life beyond those places. Do we reckon this one's going to have a longer life?
Well, the fact that it's Jewish will help it in the States.
And I mean, Nick Heidner, the press woman, did say it's going to go on a regional tour.
I thought it's a natural for the West End. I think there is so much. I think you can criticise, you know, structural things in it and things like that, but the fact is, I think it's a play that people are really going to enjoy.
Oh, no, and it does. I mean, I know this sounds like a sentimental thing to say, but it has enormous heart. Mm. And that's a really undervalued quality. I don't mean that it's sentimental. No. I don't mean that it's a Hallmark card in 2 hours. It just has this overwhelming sense of compassion. But I do think, Mark, your point about will this have a life beyond, over and above whether or not it transfers into town, I have no idea what it would be like if you just picked this script up in 2 years' time and went, right, well, I'm a producer, so I'm now going to recast it with ordinary actors that will do this script as written. What on earth would you find? You know, how much of this one wonders...
You mean like the endless productions of Abigail's Party?
Yeah. Exactly, but, you know, Abigail's Party really is tightly structured. Yeah, there are events. This is a play in which nothing happens.
Yeah.
But and yet there are emotional journeys. Quite what, you know, AN other cast will make of this, I'd be fascinated to see.
I also think it's interesting that the National have sold out 16,000 tickets between now and January. Of course, that's a 2-week run at the Haymarket. So it'll be interesting to know if it could have a longer commercial life. Thank you, Matt, Charlie, and David.
Thank you.